Debug is brought to you today by Hired. Use hired.com/debugpodcast to get 5 to 15 job offers in San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles, and also get a double signing bonus, a $4,000 bonus, when you accept a job by using the hired.com/vectorpodcast URL.
So, I don't know. I mean, we've been pals for years now, Jim, but you know, it's funny. We don't actually talk about your jobby job that much.
I know, right? What do we talk about when we hang out?
I don't know. We're too busy hanging out, being pals.
Do you remember the first time we met, Guy?
I believe it was at the Park 55 bar.
Oh, see, this is not the memory that I have.
Uh-oh.
The memory
well,
I
hopefully
have
mine's
is,
earlier so that you look like the jerk rather than mine.
We just met last week, right? the memory that I have is going to see that Banksy in Soma.
Oh, yeah.
Was that the actual first time, or was it at a bar?
You know what? That might have been that. Yeah. But I think it was like that night we were at the bar.
Probably.
And that's when I had like an actual conversation with you.
Yeah.
But yeah, Banksy had just done something in San Francisco and we took a little march out there.
Yeah. And Gruber. I don't know if you guys have heard of John Gruber.
Grubier. Yeah.
But Grubier, he decided that since we both had great names that we had to know each other, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Coming back to me now. That's a good trip. I still got their photograph somewhere.
Oh, and I'm pretty sure it's not there anymore. That used to be on my old walk to work, and I'm fairly sure it's gone now.
Oh, you used to work in that? That's cool.
Yeah. It was...
At Mule? Is it around there?
Yeah, because Mule moved down to kind of near the Twitter offices, and it was sort of near there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fairly sure it's gone now.
Well, that's a waste. Or somebody took it and sold it for like $1 million.
Yeah, somebody chipped it off a wall. Someone was telling me, a woman that I work with here, that that there was a Banksy painted on the side of the building that she and her husband live in.
Wow.
And and the city sent the owner a note saying that there's graffiti on the side of your building and you're legally obligated to rectify that. And the owner is just some old guy who lives in Texas and didn't know anything about it. And so,
oh, no.
You know, there was this huge uproar when, like, a week later it got painted over.
Oh, I mean, I guess that's part of the game. But
yeah, exactly. We wouldn't love him if it weren't like
that. Yeah, and I think he's pretty cool with that impermanence aspect to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, wait, here we are again, not talking about work.
Because work is...
This is what we do.
Yeah, exactly.
We're likely to
There's
talk
so
about
many
dancing.
More interesting things to talk about.
Yeah. But for this sake of... Go ahead.
No, I have to admit that I'm a little nervous because... So I'm the Marco Arment of not listening to podcasts. But I listened to your guys' show and just to, you know, sort of get a feel for what it's like and what we would be talking about. And man, you guys have some serious nerds on this show and you get deep into it. And here I am a lowly web guy coming on talking about HTML, I guess.
That's what I wanted you to come on for. Well, A, we don't talk enough, so good excuse.
Excellent.
B, I don't know anything about all the stuff that you know about, and it's kind of been a blind spot for this show, because you're right, we've got some pretty heavy hitters, and what you do is, it's opaque to me, basically.
Well, I think it's going to be a short show if we talk about the things that I know that you don't know, Guy.
Cool. Well, whatever, we can talk about Banksy then.
And that's it. All right. Thanks for the debug. We didn't even get the ads in.
Yeah. Just make sure to exit through the gift shop. Zing. So how'd you get into this racket, Jim?
Well, let's see here. So I've been doing web development, I guess is what we call it, for longer maybe than I should admit. Since being old and experienced in this town and in this industry is not necessarily a good thing. I'm sort of autodidactic in this and I bought, you know, it used to be that they would print out the giant, like HTML 3.2 specs.
Yeah.
So I was in a bookstore and I was probably 17 or 18. And, I think most of my friends, it must have been my junior or senior year of high school. And, I think most of my friends were, off doing much more interesting things some holiday weekend, and sat down and taught myself HTML in a weekend. And
so were you like drawn to computers? Like,
yeah, you know, I was like,
I mean, you're not a nerdy guy. I mean, you are in that you're fastidious about like cooking or something. Do you know what I mean?
But no, I can
say you're certainly not introvert.
I take issue with that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean that I don't see you as a typical introverted guy that's going to sit at home and type.
Oh no, I think we can have a whole podcast worth of discussion about what it means to be an introverted guy.
Yeah.
But no, I've always been very kind of drawn to computers and to the technical things, and it's always just fascinated me that there's a world that exists that is very clearly defined, that you can type some commands and it will execute those commands exactly, and there's no fuzziness, and it's very specific, and then you start and then you realize that oftentimes the things that you want the computer to do, it doesn't want to do. And, you know, that, of course, can be very frustrating. But everyone listening to this show has that experience on a daily basis, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, that's the it's the gratification loop of figuring things out, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I've been doing web stuff for a long time. I think people started paying me to make web things probably in the late 90s when I was in school at the University of North Carolina.
It's a good time for that.
It was a good time for that. You know, it would have been a good time for me to decide to like not be in school and probably come out here to San Francisco and fake my way into a job. although, you know, a couple years later it would have all burned to the ground. But anyway, I did stay in school. I was at UNC in Chapel Hill, where I got to work on a very cool digital library project that's still going on called iBiblio, and I'm sure
cool.
Plenty of it's a thing that people know about. Yeah. It was just I was just seeing iBiblio links passed around recently because they host the source code to the rocket that sent the guys to the moon, Apollo. The Apollo rocket.
Oh, cool.
And so they have like the source code for that. And it was such a cool and still continues to be a very cool project. They have like every Linux distribution you've probably downloaded from there at some point. Mm-hmm. It sort of captures a lot of what I originally loved about the web, which was like, I mean, you remember what it was like back when there were, when you knew everyone who was on the internet.
Right. Yeah.
And, and so it kind of captures that spirit a little bit. And I feel like we've sort of lost that in a way, you know, in the world of Facebook and social media and everything.
Yeah.
But
too many people in the world. That's the,
yes, exactly. Nobody goes to that internet thing. It's too crowded. Yeah. So I was working on that for a while. And
what was your role on that?
I had gotten hired to there was a local web shop in town that essentially gave some money, and they were just like, hire somebody that will, you know, help you do cool things. And so I worked on like an open source metadata project, and did some design and development work for a few kind of library and archive projects. I think most of them don't exist anymore. But it was mostly just a way for me to kind of hone some web chops a little bit. That's where I picked up some programming and
front end stuff or back end stuff or what?
A little bit of both. You know, I was I was like teaching myself Perl on the side, and sort of learning scripting languages. And I never formally like went to school to learn computer science, but I did take enough classes to be sort of dangerous.
That's 90% of the business.
Exactly. You know, I graduated, I ended up with a journalism degree, but it was, we just started this kind of like multimedia journalism program. And so it was a lot of, like building like Flash. Like Flash was the big thing. You know, I graduated in 2001, and so learning ActionScript and how to make tween animations and stuff like that in Flash, and how you do digital online multimedia storytelling with that. Mm-hmm. And did a lot of Flash stuff for the first kind of half of my media career, where I was working. I was at the Chicago Tribune for a few years, and then I was at MSNBC.com for a few years. Mm-hmm. And spent way too much time writing ActionScript, building like slideshow players, that kind of stuff.
Hmm. How do you like Flash?
My
personal opinion is that I think it gets a bad rap. I think that for the time, it was the only
it filled a hole like ActiveX.
Yeah, like it kind of had to be there, right?
Yeah, exactly. It certainly was a yeah, you're right. It was the only way, particularly if you wanted to do stuff with animation or any of the kind of like artsy stuff that people were doing with Flash. I still have a kind of a soft spot in my heart for that. And I saw recently that the Homestar Runner guys are talking about coming back and doing some more episodes. And when I read that, I then of course had to go back and like watch every Strong Bad email from 2005. And,
so I hope our listeners know who Strong Bad is. Strong Bad. If you don't, just go watch out the Strong
Bad. Just pause.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And there was that sort of quirky stuff that mm-hmm. that people were doing with Flash that
you really couldn't have done in any other media.
No, exactly. Like, I mean, I guess you could have like tried to sit down and do a traditional animation, but like, who has time for that?
It's funny. You and I had incredibly similar early careers, except where you went to media, I went to enterprise, and I spent 3 to 4 years just making Flash stuff for enterprise sites that showed data flying back and forth between cylinders.
See, and then there was a lot of that. And that's the part of the Flash world that, cause I spent, you know, plenty of time. You know, like how many XML parsers have you written in ActionScript and tried to make them do a thing that there's no reason to be doing in Flash? And,
That sounds horrible.
Yeah, that part of the Flash world I was maybe a little bit excited or a little bit happy to see die, and mm-hmm. it sort of be replaced with, you know, everything that's kind of replaced it since 2007. Now that we're doing a lot more stuff with JavaScript and CSS and all of the new stuff that's being built into the browsers, I think a lot of that is interesting. I think, I am actually a little bit sad that some of the weird, quirky, artsy stuff that people were doing with Flash, mm-hmm. Are people still doing that kind of stuff on the internet in general?
I don't know.
Well, I miss the cannonballs, but all that stuff kind of went to iOS and mobile apps.
No, I guess that's it. I guess, you know, Flash or apps are the new Flash, right? In some ways for those things.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
monetize them.
Yeah, I'm sure that doesn't hurt. I mean, the closest I can think of is, you know, those web pages where you, I'm sure you know how this works more than I do, but you scroll down and stuff happens.
Oh, yeah.
Like it tells a little story as you're vertically scrolling.
Right, although exactly.
The kids, like if you go to any kids network, you'll see tons of games still written in Shockwave or in Flash.
Oh yeah. No, that's a good point. I guess there is still plenty of still plenty of like games, and even on Facebook and things like that. Like I'm sure Zynga has like a million Flash coders that are just making more fun.
Oh, I didn't even think Bunker.
See, this is how I understand web stuff is it didn't occur to me that Facebook could embed Flash.
Yeah, you know, I don't have a great insight into that world very much either.
Know it because I don't have Flash installed, so I get that big angry Flash block on Facebook.
Yeah,
all the time.
I never go to Facebook, but that is interesting.
Yeah, because and even 5 or 6 years ago, that's how people were. Maybe before apps, that's how people were monetizing their little Flash widgets, was that they were putting them on they were making the Farmville style, like weren't there like buy a zombie kind of games and jump like that?
Video too, because I think Flash was the primary DRM platform for a lot of people for a long time as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. And I definitely wrote plenty of code in my life, trying to handle various video implementations. And, you know, and like all of that stuff just went out the window when the iPhone came out. And it was so dramatic to watch how quickly that dropped off. And I mean, like, you know, there was for probably a year, there was still some back and forth where like the, you know, the Adobe and the Flash evangelists and even the Android people were like, oh no, we're going to make Flash work on mobile. And Apple was just adamant. They were like, you know, show us the money, show us the battery performance.
And Apple got blamed. Like Apple got blamed for not giving people Flash, even though it did not exist.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, they took the blame, but I mean, they also made the decision that they weren't even going to try. Yeah. Like Steve Jobs literally came out and stomped on the idea.
Well, I think if Adobe could have shown
open letter, which is like very uncommon, right?
Because I had the Androids, I had the BlackBerry phones, I had the WebOS phone that could run Flash, and it was garbage. If they'd made something that was fantastic, then I think Apple's position would have been much less tenable.
I
think I'm with you on that one, Renee. I think that, you know, if Adobe a year later had come out and said, like, here's a mobile version of Flash that will not have an appreciable impact on battery life and actually has a compelling use case for people, then it's so hard to tell because I do think that Apple really benefited from the transition away from Flash into things like apps. So, you know, maybe the politics wouldn't have been quite right. But right.
It's one of those weird things where, Microsoft did a lot of these kind of moves in the 90s where they throw their weight around and sort of change the direction of the industry.
Yeah.
Apple did it in the case of Flash, but they actually had a compelling argument. And I think, what your point is like if Adobe could have shown a functional Flash, it would have at least made Apple either ship it, unlikely, or at least get political egg on their face.
I think one of the apparent
that they're throwing the weight around.
One of the things is that Flash, because it had really no competition for a long time, like Internet Explorer 6 and ActiveX, became incredibly complacent. And then when something like HTML5 came along, the same way when WebKit and Gecko came along, suddenly they had to struggle really hard, and it took them a long time to catch up. And by then, the industry passed them by.
Yeah. And I knew so many people. Because, you know, obviously I hung out on like Flash forums and things like that. They're very sad, desolate corners of the internet. but so many people were so angry because they had invested so much time and so much. This is a lesson to you kids out there. Yeah. Investing in a platform is almost never a great idea. But investing in sort of thinking about how to solve a problem is ultimately going to be how you thrive in an industry that changes very quickly all the time.
It was also very alien to Adobe. Adobe, when I grew up, was creative. It was creative tools. And then for a while there, they bought Omniture and they bought the Macromedia stuff and they wanted to start owning platforms. And I think that never fit well with them.
Yeah, it is a bit of an odd fit. And it seems like they're kind of coming around on that now where they're trying to do really good work. And I think that if they can really get ahead of it, it's possible that Flash, the authoring environment, may still have an interesting life ahead of it if it can really export HTML5 kind of code. I mean, they can sort of do it now, but I don't really know anyone who's just like, I got to download Flash so that I can make this whiz-bang web page.
Right. I want to get back to a point you just made about investing in platforms almost always being a bad idea. I just want to underscore that because I think it's entirely true. And I do worry that I'm overly invested in sort of Apple platforms at times.
You're a smart guy. And so, you know, you'll be able to translate the stuff that you know how to do to whatever the next platform is, right?
Sure. I'm not overly worried, but a lot of the conversations that I try to have on this show try to get outside that Apple platform, which is, again, one of the reasons I want to talk to you about web stuff. We've done a couple of shows on C# and stuff. So trying to learn the greater world, because I really do think that that's an important point to make to listeners, is that investing in any platform, even Apple, as much as I love it, is probably a bad idea, right? It's a,
Well, and it's a tricky line to walk, right? Because there's a certain amount of nuance that you need to understand, and there's a certain amount of details. Like, you know, I knew that there were buggy parts of ActionScript that I just knew to avoid, and that, you know, those are the kind of details that don't really translate to anything else. But to be able to so to be able to kind of lock in on and have some expertise within a platform, but also to be able to kind of think a little bit more broadly about how you do things. Like the first time I saw the iPhone, I knew that this was going to be, you know, just like we all did. We all looked at that thing and we're like, this is going to be the future. And not just that this is going to be the future, but this is going to be the future that I want to live in. Right. And if they're telling me that I can't make Flash to do that, then okay, show me jQuery, show me HTML5, show me, you know, CSS animations, whatever that thing is, and I'll go learn that.
So were you excited? So 2007 is an inflection point, right?
Totally.
HTML5 had been out for a couple of years.
It was definitely starting to HTML5 was starting to be exciting because first of all, it was just like people were interested in the spec again, and people were interested in kind of pushing the boundaries of HTML5 again. Mm-hmm. I mean, so much of the work that I did on in HTML between about 2003 and 2008 was making it work in IE6. Mm-hmm. And that's just not exciting. That's just not interesting. And then all of a sudden these guys come along and they're just like, you know what? Like, rewriting the HTML for spec in a yet another version of XML isn't that exciting. Let's take it and actually push the envelope a little.
Yeah. So wait, let's, if listeners are like me, they probably have a very cursory understanding of this history, but, HTML,
I'm probably going to get it wrong.
It doesn't matter. This is a pretty, this is a very much a best effort show.
All right, cool. I love an A for effort.
Yeah, yeah. HTML got what, to 3.2, and then a bunch of standard stuff tried to come in, like another standards body that tried to rewrite it as XHTML. Correct? Like it got real complicated, real fast, right?
It was like HTML4 and XHTML1. Trying to simultaneously be competitive and exist in the same space, and they you know, there were these hacky things, these hacky workarounds, like and depending on where your personal biases lied, like if you really wanted to your code to be able to be validated by XML parsers, then it was probably important for you to write XHTML, which was functionally very similar to HTML 4.1, I guess.
Super strict though. Like if you don't close the tag, you're at the end of the world.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Whereas with HTML, which as we all remember, of course, was a subset of SGML, you know, it was a little bit more forgiving. And then of course it was left up to the browsers to implement this so that even if you wrote XHTML that was not valid, most browsers still let you write it because they knew that the web still had to work for end users, and end users didn't care about whether or not your XHTML validated.
Right.
Blah, blah. So yeah, I'm oh my God, oh, you're bringing up such horrible memories.
I don't mean to.
Like fights that I would get into with people online.
Oh really? Oh, so you
a brash 25-year-old?
So you'd actually pick fights about this?
I'm not sure I would pick fights about it, but you know they would devolve into long email chains or long you know online discussions in places like Slashdot and stuff like that.
Really?
Yeah,
you argued on Slashdot.
Slashdot Green.
Everybody argued on Slashdot. It's part of growing up.
Of course.
And you argued on Dig, and now you argue on Reddit.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Hacker News, probably point.
Yeah.
So HTML5 kind of comes out of this. In a weird way, it's basically a bunch of people saying, screw it.
I mean, it was kind of like a guerrilla effort.
Right.
Yeah. Sort of like, you know what? We're tired of these guys that are just, they're squabbling about stuff that really doesn't make any difference and certainly is not pushing the medium forward at all. Yeah. And so
I got the sense that there was a bit of a bike shed problem going on.
Yeah.
You know, just to explain the metaphor, it's like everybody thinks they know exactly how to build a bike shed. And so everybody puts input into it, right? And I got the sense that it's like, that's what was happening to HTML standards committees at the time.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that, when Hixie was like, you know what, I'm not interested in that. I'm just going to kind of start my own. And he sort of cheekily kind of started his own standards group, himself. And then other smart people, you know, like the web standards people that, like Jeffrey Zeldman and the Event Apart folks or List Apart folks and those guys, you know, they came on board and you know, like basically what happened was enough smart people came on board and said, like, we want to push the web forward.
Right.
And we don't really care about getting into arguments about what the syntax should look like.
Right. I mean, they took a pragmatic approach rather than the top approach.
Yeah. And it was good. I think, you know, that certainly helped. jQuery was becoming a thing. jQuery and Scriptaculous and those early JavaScript libraries were starting to become a thing. And that was happening right before the iPhone, but you could kind of start to see some alternatives to Flash. And so Ajax was becoming a thing. And so all of that was starting to happen. And then advancements were being made to CSS and then
Ajax had been a thing for a while, hadn't it?
It had, but it was like the implementation, like each browser did it differently, of course.
Right.
And so there wasn't really like a great way to do it. And then jQuery came along and said, like, we're going to make this pretty easy for you. And you know, there were things that I would write in Flash that I would do just because it let me sort of skirt around the cross-site scripting protections that browsers had built into them and be like, oh man, you know what?
Exactly, the wrong reasons, but
yeah, well, kind of.
I mean, like, you're a good actor, so.
Well, and you know, Flash, because Flash is sort of this like sandbox black hole that doesn't get into the security of the browser per se. Now, obviously there are a lot of security holes and security vectors via Flash that we're still dealing with. But, you know, you could do things like load XML from another domain as long as that domain had added you to their cross-site XML file. And so, you know, you could do stuff like that pretty easily. I mean, we've come up with solutions to all of this stuff now, that don't require Flash, but you know, all of that stuff was kind of like the Ajax stuff had been happening for a while. And then, you know, things like jQuery, things like HTML5, things like, you know, being able to do keyframe animations in CSS,
right.
Things like SVG showing up so that you could do, SVGs continues to be really important now as we have like these high resolution screens and stuff. All of this stuff was kind of frothing about. And then Steve gets on stage and he introduces the iPhone and he talks about, and I don't feel like we even talk about the iPhone this way anymore, but you know, he gets up there and he's talking about like a widescreen video iPod and an internet communicator. Mm-hmm. And like who says internet communicator anymore?
It was a Nokia thing. They were actually selling internet communicators at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
there was these little tablets that you'd go on Wi-Fi and all they could do was browse the web.
Oh, yeah. I remember that now. Okay. So it was actually, there was like a reason he said that.
I think it was just a common name.
Yeah, just, I guess just, like just I always thought it was funny. Yeah. I was just like, wow, that's what a weird way to say that.
Well, because the funny thing is that it didn't really matter until Twitter really took off, right? Like the internet communicator thing.
Yeah.
And,
well, how do you mean?
Well, how do I mean is that I think since 2007, way more people communicate over the internet than they did at the time. And I think way more people at least feel that they need a device in their pocket in order to use Facebook or Twitter or
just seems like a great fit.
Snapchat or whichever one it is, you know? Yeah. Like I think the iPhone came in the iPhone and devices like it, including Android, made mobile communication what it is today.
Sure.
Well, so I think a lot of people had BlackBerries, but that was mostly an enterprise thing.
But that's textual and like not, yeah. I mean, Instagram would not be a thing. Like, yeah. Facebook, probably still huge, but not as like, you know, addictive.
And
as,
mobile Safari was light years ahead of like Pocket IE and the other browsers at the time.
Yeah.
You know, what phone did you guys upgrade to from when you got your first iPhones?
I think I had it was a Motorola, like a flip phone.
The Razor?
It was some kind of Razor. Yeah. I can't remember the model number, but it had a button that you would hit. It looked like a globe. I've told the story before, but it looked like a globe with like, you know, the lines on it. Longitude and latitude lines. Like that's the way of saying the world. And you'd hit that button and it would internet on you. And
it was like a WAP browser.
Yeah, it would launch a WAP browser.
It was a WAP and I could never figure out how to escape it. Like pages would be loading I could never quite figure out exactly what to do to quit it. And the entire time I was totally stressed because I was like, this is just costing me so much money.
You never really knew. Like remember early data plans? Like they didn't really exist. So you were just like, I think this is costing me $5 or $50.
I really did. I felt like I had a trapdoor button on my phone that if I hit it, I couldn't figure out how to escape and it would just cost me money.
Really bad here because I had two phones before then. I had a Trio 680 with a Blazor browser and it was awesome because I think it was like 320 by 320 by then resolution. Went up from 160 in the previous generations. And I had a Trio Pro, which was running the Palm version of Windows Mobile that had Pocket IE. But it was, I don't know if you remember this guy, but before the iPhone, it was $200 for 100 megabytes of data a month.
Yeah, I do remember because like I'm not joking about this. I hit that button and I felt like that trouble in the pit of your stomach.
Yes.
Like this is a bad, bad thing.
Yeah. But I have to answer this question because everybody wants to know who that actor from that movie was. And so I'm the only guy who has the internet phone at the bar.
But I treated that thing like it was bleeding money. Like I did.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I think I actually had one of the phones that Steve made fun of when he put that slide up.
Oh,
it was
awesome.
It looked like a Nokia E71, I think. And, you know, it looked like an HP calculator from the 70s, probably.
Yeah, but those HP calculators are cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I still have that thing. I should dig it up and take a picture of it. I bricked it at some point. But you couldn't buy them in the U.S., so I had to get mine from a reseller on eBay. And it had the alternate character set was Arabic, and it was like printed like it had the Roman character set, but then it like above it had like an Arabic character set.
whichever
importer I bought it from had bought it in Saudi Arabia or something like that and sent it to me, and that's how I got my my cool super nerdy. I mean, like that thing is the kind of phone you just like, you know, store in your pocket protector. It was not cool at all.
I dig that it's got the Arabic character.
That was maybe the coolest thing about it.
It's so cool. Yeah. It's kind of funny because these days it's like, well, I mean, they're all just, you know, you can pick apart the differences, but effectively it's a piece of glass with a display on it, right?
Sure.
So the fact that you can get like physical keyboard with Arabic characters, it's like an Underwood typewriter or cell phones at this point. It's actually
kind of
cool.
Like a Blade Runner quality to it. Right. Yes.
And again, we're not talking about work. I was about to go into Blade Runner talk with you.
We can do that. I can talk Blade Runner all day. Seriously.
Yeah, I know. Me too. We got a show to do.
Yeah, So anyway, you know, that's all old history, though. What are the things that we're excited about that's coming up? Because I got some stuff that I'm excited about.
Okay, shoot. Yeah, you want to go for it?
Well, so here was the challenge that I still could not, like, having listened to a few episodes of the show that you guys are doing, I had no idea what I was going to talk about with you guys because you're like Mac guys, and so I live in a weird world where I'm friends with a ton of you guys that are all Mac nerds and developers and things like that. But I myself am not a Mac partisan. And
that's why we love you, Jim.
Yeah. And well, it's funny because like every time you guys all come to town, it's like, oh, you go to WWDC, but then you're out drinking till 3 o'clock every morning. And like, I don't get to hang out with you because I still have to go to work because like,
you've got a real life.
Because I don't get to take the week off to go learn about Nerd Christmas at WWDC. I have to go like make web pages for people. So, but you know, there was some really cool stuff that came out of WWDC that I was really excited about. Mm-hmm. That I think if you're a web person or a media person who does things on the web but also does apps and stuff, then I think that they introduced some stuff that I think is going to be pretty cool. Specifically around the new WK WebView class.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So you guys talk about that a little bit because I've done as much as I'm super interested in Swift and I'm super interested in the new WK WebView class, and I've gotten as far as building a little app that will display a web page that is hard coded in a WebView class that I can like compile and see in what do we call that?
I don't know. When you run the program,
there we go. The simulator.
Playground.
I can like,
iOS app. Yeah.
Yeah. But I can't, that's as far as I've gotten with that. So I think that stuff is really interesting, but maybe you guys can tell me what that means for apps, or maybe I can posit about what I think it means for apps.
Well, so there's a few interesting things. On iOS, previously, you didn't get access to the fastest JavaScript runtime.
Right.
And the reason that is because behind the scenes, the JavaScript would be compiled into native executable code and then just executed. Huge security flaw.
Right.
Right. You can't just arbitrarily download code from the internet and run it on your device because you're just begging for trouble at that point.
Right.
Safari allowed it because they could wall off Safari in a way that they felt that like the worst that can happen is Safari can explode.
Right.
Now all of the web views, anywhere in the system on iOS, get to use this new advanced compiler technology. And they've done that by way of they run the JavaScript in a separate process from your process and then effectively funnel in and out, like all of the results.
Interesting.
So it's walled off so that if it goes ape, at least it doesn't have access to what your application has access to. Yeah. Because if you say your application has access to the contacts and then some rogue JavaScript executes in your contacts and steals all the contacts.
Right.
Bad, right?
Yeah.
So they've managed to wall that off.
Now, is that related to all, to like a bunch of the other stuff that they announced about, you know, like third party keyboards and so all of that, like basically they figured out whatever piece they needed to figure out.
And they rewrote a lot of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. They rewrote a lot. So they've got this thing called XPC. It's process communication. I'm imagining the X just means cross process communication, close enough. You know, I don't know what they actually call it, but XPC. And they've had that for a while, and in this release, they've kind of managed to build it all out in order to support all of these kind of things, like the extensions, the keyboards, this JavaScript for web views, all sits on top of this XPC thing.
Cool.
Which in turn sits on top of something way down low in the kernel called like mock message passing, which has been around since the 80s kind of thing.
Gotcha.
But they've finally made like a – They've built a layer on top of the mock message passing that they are really, in no small way, sort of betting the OS on at this point.
Yeah.
And that seems sort of fundamental to a lot of the advances that they're promoting in iOS 8, right? So like they figured out their XPC game, and now they're like, now we can look at all this cool shit that we can do.
Yeah, it's the key element for sure.
I'm going to take a quick break so I can tell you about Drobo. Drobo is smart storage to protect what matters. If any of you are familiar with RAID arrays, you know that they can provide large amounts of storage. They can sometimes do redundant storage. They can sometimes do super fast storage, but they are complex beasts and they are also really onerous if you run out of space to try to move to a bigger one. You take stuff off, put stuff back on again. It's a complete mess. Drobo makes all of that easy. It is safe. It can protect your data. It's also expandable. It can grow as your needs grow. For example, if you have a Drobo with a 1 terabyte, you know, 4 1-terabyte disks in there and they get full, you can pull out one of those 1 terabyte disks, push in a 2 terabyte disk, and it will take advantage of the extra space. When it's done reconfiguring, you just pull out another 1 terabyte disk, take another 2 terabyte disk, 3 terabyte disk. As storage capacity expands, Drobo can expand. They offer models with 4, 5, or 8 drive capacities, USB 3, Thunderbolt plus USB 3, NAS if you want to go on the network attached, you have iSCSI, you have all of these possibilities. I want to tell you more about the Gen 3 Drobo. This is the classic though. This is the original. I had one of the original Drobos and I've always been fond of this form factor. So I launched it at Macworld earlier this year and it's an update to that classic one. But what it does is it adds USB 3.0 connectivity. It is 3 to 5 times faster than its predecessors. It's got a new dual core microprocessor and super speed USB 3.0 interface. It can get 200 megabytes per second. It also gives you better options for data protection. For example, you can choose whether you want to optimize for space and have just one backup, one redundancy, protect against one drive failure, or you can maximize for protection and, you know, make sure that you can survive 2 hard drive failures at the same time. It's great for Time Machine. It's great for storing all your media files, all your development files, anything that you want to make sure you have a second copy of locally and you have a lot of space to store that. Drobo is just fantastic for that. Best of all, the list price is only $349. That's 1/3 cheaper than the one that came before. And if you have one of those original ones like I do, you can just literally pull out the disks in it, stick the disks in the new one, and you are back up and running immediately. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to drobostore.com and use offer code DEBUG50. That'll get you $50 off the Drobo of your choice, whether it is the Gen 3 or one of the larger capacity or NAS or whatever models. Use code DEBUG50, drobostore.com. Save $50 off your purchase of any Drobo. Thanks, Drobo.
Do you recall, Guy, if they brought the 4th tier LLVM stuff to Mobile Safari and UK WebView?
I was thinking of saying that, but I can't say it for sure. And again, you know, best effort show.
I feel like they did, yeah, but yeah. I don't know what I have to base that on.
Exactly.
Yeah. I know that we have the faster JavaScript parser. I don't know if it's the LLVM.
So they've got 4 stages now, which is interesting. Like the first stage is they just interpret it. Second stage is, what do? They compile like a little bit if you've used it, if it function more than once.
Yeah.
Sure.
This Thursday.
I'm nodding my head like I have any idea what you're talking about.
I want to explain the notion. Somebody out there is like getting really angry at me. Hey, Syracuse, how's it going, man? So the idea is that compiling anything takes a bit of time, right? So if it's faster to just interpret JavaScript, that's what they'll do. If you end up interpreting the JavaScript frequently, then they estimate that the costs of just interpreting it will be outweighed or like will be greater than the cost of just compiling it once. And they've got 4 stages of this kind of decision-making process. With each subsequent stage takes more time, but makes things go faster in the end. So it's kind of this waterfall effect of, if you're just going to do one little thing fast, they'll just do it.
Right.
If you're running basically like a giant app written in JavaScript, it'll effectively all end up getting compiled and just running, I don't want to say native speed, but fast, like way faster than you would expect for regular JavaScript.
Hella fast, as we say here in the
Bay Area. Hella fast, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are they saying in the South?
Nothing's fast in the South.
Just I want to talk about barbecue with you. Yeah.
In the South, we say, that boy's going to get himself into trouble if he doesn't slow down.
So what is it that excited you about this stuff?
Oh, so, you know, definitely here's what I saw that came out of that. And I think it was Vicky Murley had a tweet that was making the rounds, and I don't even remember what it was, but I saw that and I was instantly excited, and I logged in to my developer account because once again, I didn't get to go have fun with all you guys and go to WWDC.
Do you know Vicky?
I don't. And I'll need to introduce me to Renee at some point, you need to introduce me to Vicky as well.
She's great. Aces.
I kickstarted her book and it's great.
Yeah.
And she's obviously super sharp. She had a tweet that sort of got me very excited about whatever was announced. And then there was a talk specifically about using that WK WebView class that I watched and that, you know, I just followed along and I was like, hey, cool, I can make a Wikipedia app. And basically, I think the thing that came out of that to me wasn't like the specifics of like, hey, we're finally gonna like stop hobbling the JavaScript interpreter and stuff like that.
That's an unfair characterization. But not an uncommon one, which is why it's why I'm calling you out on it. They weren't hobbling it.
Yeah,
it was security.
They were taking a risk within their own confined space of Safari.
You know, but the thing is, at the end of the day, the end user doesn't care about that. The only thing the end user cares about is like, why is my JavaScript slow when I'm in a web view but not in Safari?
I totally agree. I 100% agree, and I'm on board with that.
Yeah.
Just the word hobbling comes up a lot, and it's like, this is not a choice that they made in order to piss anybody off.
It's interesting.
It's not a political choice, right? It's a practical choice.
I want to get back to my original point here, but since we've diverted briefly, I think even as recently as the day before WWDC this year, you could have probably made a compelling conspiratorial kind of case that Apple was in fact hobbling not making the web a sort of first class citizen on OS, especially since they seriously broke some stuff in iOS 7. Like, if you remember web clips, remember like that was Steve Jobs' like sweet solution to making apps. Like WebKit or web clips in iOS 7 are so broken. Oh. I use them mostly for prototyping and things like that. But they are seriously broken in iOS 7. And I think this is
exactly the kind of thing that I'm totally blind to.
I think you could have made a case that Apple was intentionally crippling the web to make way for native apps, which is, you know, where like if you make a really great web app and it works really well on iOS 7, guess what? Apple doesn't get 30%. If you make a really great app and you have to charge people for it, then, you know, Apple collects their 30%. I never really believed that conspiracy theory. I tend to subscribe to the Hanlon razor of, never ascribe to malice that can be explained by incompetence. Yeah. And I'm not even sure it was incompetent. It was pretty clear that they didn't prioritize it. Right.
Yeah.
But that
does make sense. It is, after all, in their best interest.
Sure.
I don't think
that they were intentionally crippling the internet, and I think the way you have explained it about how JavaScript gets compiled and executed, and you have to make sure that it's in a safe place so that you don't have people arbitrarily executing JavaScript that can take down the whole OS, blah blah blah. Like, all of that makes sense to me, and I think it's good, and I'm glad that they finally sorted that out in iOS 8. Mm-hmm. So I was super excited about that. And I think at this point now, cause with iOS 7, like the thing that they needed people to buy into was this whole new aesthetic that they were introducing, a whole new UI and all that sort of stuff. And so things slipped, right? And one of the things that slipped was, hey, guess what? Your web clips are going to suck. And they're just not going to work like you expect them to. And but I do think that Apple genuinely wants to have and genuinely wants WebKit to be the best web parser, if that's what we're going to call it, sure, that exists. They want it to be better than Gecko. They want it to be better than Blink. They want it to be better than whatever it is IE uses these days. And they want it to be the best that it is. And I think that, like, you know, looking at the stuff that's coming out with iOS 8, like, they can make that case with a straight face now. They can mm-hmm. be like, you know what? Like, we make the best, like, WebKit exists across all of our platforms. And it's the best, and look at how awesome it is. But
that's true. I had heard the conspiracy theory, but I'd never given it much credo because I don't really run in that web world. I did, like, for example, I didn't know that the web clips were bust. I know a lot of people there, and I know that they're not trying to do that.
They always prided themselves on their web app implementation.
But I think, like you say, stuff happens. Go ahead.
No, I think the web clip thing was a bigger deal for, like, enterprise people because I know that there were plenty of there's plenty of enterprises where they have, like, 20,000 employees and 500 people in their IT shop make web apps, and they need some way to make the global directory accessible to people on their iPhones. And so people would turn those kinds of things into web clips. And so I think that's where you would probably hear the complaints from. And since, you know, like, is Apple really going to prioritize, like, bugs in WebKit from enterprise people? Like how far down the priority ladder does that actually fall?
I don't know. I mean, IBM may have something to say about that.
I don't know if I remember this right, but was it web.app that supports the web clips? And they gave that Nitro and JIT compiling a couple versions ago, so it got pretty fast.
Yeah, it was. I remember that when the Nitro compiler came out, and that was what was it? iOS 5?
Somewhere around there. And it was only in Safari at first, and then it went to web.app, and it never went to WebView.
Yeah, and then there was another sort of intermediary advancement that they made to, like, the JavaScript stuff that also didn't make it downstream. But now in iOS 8, I guess every performance enhancement they make to WebKit would just be available to everyone for free, right?
I think so.
Seems like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my understanding, at least.
Yeah. So getting back to the original point, that I feel like sometimes I have the conversational equivalent of, like, an open parentheses, and I just need to close the parentheses.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what I'm super excited about, is looking at, I think the way that I would state that is, like, the language of the internet and that's kind of broadly defined, but we'll say HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and all of the kind of things that get wrapped up into the modern web. Like, we could consider that a first class citizen on iOS now in a way that we had never been able to before. And I think that's interesting, and that's really powerful. I think it's going to be compelling to a whole new group of developers, particularly when it's coupled with something like Swift. I know a lot of web developers and JavaScript programmers and things like that, and Python programmers and Ruby programmers that look at Swift and they're like, oh, I already know this. And I don't quite believe them. but I think that Swift
close enough
is,
that
I think, you know, like, you know that scene in The Matrix where, like, Neo comes out for the first time, he's like, I know Kung Fu.
Right.
And, like, I feel like every web developer I know is just like, I know Swift. And it's like, not quite. Like it's, first of all, it's still kind of in beta, and secondly, like, it's gonna be harder than we think it is. But it's much more accessible. Like writing an iOS app is much more accessible than it's ever been for people who do not come from a background of C, for instance. Mm-hmm. And
that's great to hear. That's encouraging. To me, Swift feels a little bit alien.
Okay.
But I understand. I'm like, yeah, okay, I've seen a lot of stuff like this. But it's that other stuff that I don't, you know?
And I come from a background of Python and JavaScript, and I look at that, and I'm just like, that looks like something that I've written before.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And so,
So I think that's encouraging because I think there's a lot more people like you out there than there are people like me.
Well, I
wait, don't take that the wrong way.
I hope it is encouraging.
That could be taken the worst way possible, but I don't mean it like that.
We'll just let it slide.
Yeah.
I think the combination of those things, I think that like the number of people who know that stuff, can now look at iOS as a much more viable platform.
Yeah.
And I also think that people who,
you used the word viable, I think.
Yeah.
Less intimidating may be a better description.
Less intimidating is probably a better way of putting that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cause I guess it's always been a viable platform, but,
right.
But yeah, less intimidating. Something that you could conceivably see yourself picking up and.
Yeah. Like you may do it like everybody's away. I got a weekend. I'll try something.
Just like me with my HTML 3.2 book when all my friends went to the beach.
Exactly.
I think that like over the next year or so, especially once Swift starts to kind of gel a little bit more, I think we'll see people that maybe would not have considered a career like doing native app development for iOS, like maybe transitioning to do that a little bit more. And I think we'll see a class of apps that maybe we wouldn't have seen otherwise. I think that'll be pretty, pretty interesting.
That's great. That's really encouraging. Do you see yourself becoming interested in client side stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because of Swift or just because of, I don't know.
History. We haven't maybe talked about this part so much, but my background is I do web stuff, but I also I have a media background. So
yeah.
I worked at the Chicago Tribune for a while. I worked at MSNBC for a while. I went and worked in client services for a little bit, but then now I'm back. I'm working for a small media company here in San Francisco, and we're launching a magazine this fall. And I look at like Swift, and I look at the new WebView stuff, and there's other stuff that's built into WK WebView beyond just the faster compile stuff.
Like, oh yeah, there's lots of stuff.
Like there's user scripts, right?
Yep.
And you can do things like look at the content of a page, they did an example of this with like the Wikipedia in the WWDC video or session that they did. But you can pull the navigation out of a web page and put it into a native element now. So you can build a very native feeling app, the data of which is all driven by a web page. So now you can build a whole ecosystem pretty easily that publishes to the web, and then your app pulls from that stuff to the web, and it feels native where it needs to feel native with things like the navigation. But then when it comes to like rendering the content, you know, that's just HTML and CSS, right?
Which is great because one of the roughest parts of web apps on iOS to date has been all of the rigmarole of trying to mimic native controls.
Yeah, right.
Like down to the scrolls or the back button, like the.
Yeah.
They've given you a way to break that stuff out while still using the richness of the web to render your content.
Yeah, exactly. And we're hitting this convergent point where there's new stuff coming into CSS and HTML and JavaScript that is making mobile web development feel more native. You know, we can do multi-column layouts, and we can do CSS shapes and profiles, and we have web workers that can be processing JavaScript in the background, and so we can start to build web apps that start to feel a little bit more native within the web. But then I think this other stuff that's happening on the native side that is pulling more from the web is super interesting as well. And so as those things kind of converge, I think the ability to create platforms that exist outside of just iOS or just the web becomes a lot more interesting.
I think that's a great way of looking at it.
I'm super excited about it. Yeah. I like, if you're at all interested in how people communicate on the web, or at all interested in what we have sort of traditionally called publishing, like if you, you know, there's never a better time. There's never been a better time to like create a new magazine or to create a new, you know, we like,
you don't want to say?
No, well,
it's like you're excited about something you can't talk about yet.
No, I'm just like, I guess 5 years ago we would have said a new blog, right? And so, but like,
so wait, maybe we can say it this way: is that there's so many possibilities. We have a richness of possibility now to do something new.
Yes.
And I think the fact that you're struggling to say what the word is part of that, right? Like, we don't know what this thing can be. Like, it is something new. So there's no word that you can just pull out of your hat to describe it.
Yeah. I will take that charitable, approached guy as your,
well, cause it's not a magazine. I mean, we say the word magazine, but. That's
certainly not in the
anymore.
Way that we like think about a magazine that, you know, like I get the New Yorker delivered to my house every week. And, the only reason I do that is so that I can read it online. Right.
Number of New Yorkers at Jim Ray's house, 800.
Yeah. Well, they just stack up. Oh, speaking of, if you guys have not looked at the New Yorker's new website, you should do that because it's great. And
did you do it?
iOS app still sucks. No. They have a really, really bright team of people who worked very hard on putting together their new website. And they're rethinking like their paywall and all of this stuff right now. So you can go read any article that they've published since 2007 on their website.
Oh, wow.
And they're right now, if you want to read an article from more than 5 or 6 years ago, then you have to they have this really janky setup where you essentially have to read like a scanned image version of that article, which is
that's kind of cool.
It's such
it reminds me I don't know when it was, maybe early 2000, late 1990s. I got a whole set of CDs with like National Geographic on them.
Totally, yeah, it's exactly.
And it was awesome, and also just totally janky.
The one cool thing about like I at the magazine where I work, we were referencing I had to go look up an article in the New Yorker from like 1997, I think. Wow. And so, you know, I log in and I find the article, and it was a huge pain in the ass. But once I finally found it, one of the really cool things about this otherwise horrible user experience is that they've literally just scanned in every page of each issue of the back catalog.
Yeah.
So you see them as they were printed. You see like the layout, you see the graphic design, you also see the ads, you see like the cartoon that ran next to it. That part is pretty cool. So you can
That's pretty cool. Yeah, that's probably value in that. Yeah. I mean, it's like microfiche, right? Like,
yeah, it's just like microfiche, except it's in a web browser and you hate yourself.
But I'm looking at it now. What a beautiful site. Their typography is amazing.
We're going to take a quick moment so I can tell you more about Lynda.com. Lynda.com is an easy and affordable way to help you as an individual or your organization, your team, learn any practical skill, almost any practical skill that you can imagine. They offer thousands of courses. They're streamed by experts in software and web development and graphic design and more. Lynda, they work directly with industry experts. They get the people who know the stuff the best to teach it to you in the best way possible. There are new courses added daily, and they're always on top of new releases. So when a new version of something comes out, they almost always have new courses available for it day and date. They give you great tools. It's segmented so that you can watch for just as little or just as long as you have. You can start on one device. You know, they have applications for iPhone, for iPad, for Android. You can start on your web. You can start then move over to your mobile device, move back again. They really want to make sure they remove any barrier at all to you learning, to you getting the information. You have beginner to advanced courses. And they offer unlimited access for one low monthly price. $25 gives you access to 100,000 video tutorials. Their newest courses include managing your mobile photos, Google Docs and Sheets for iOS, iPad for Business, up and running with OpenGL, creating mobile games with Unity. So really, they cover the complete spectrum of possibilities here. And they even have a premium plan. So if you want to upgrade, you can download the courses to your iPhone, iPad, or Android. You can watch them offline. You can also download project files and practice along with the instructor. So if you need, I mean, time was that if you wanted to learn a skill, you had to go find someone teaching it in your area, join a group, you know, try and find a program at a local university. You had to expend time and money. And the quality of what you learned really depended on luck, on you finding someone who happened to be really good, not only at that thing, but at teaching that thing. And knowing and teaching are two very separate skills. Lynda.com gets the best people possible and puts them right in front of you. We've also managed to work out a special offer with them. You can sign up and you will get 7 days for free. All you have to do is go to lynda.com/debug and you can try it out 7 days. That's lynda.com, lynda.com/debug. If there is any skill that would make you better at your current job, get you promoted, get you a new job, or just, you know, great new hobby, something you're interested in, don't wait. You know, just go do it today. lynda.com/debug. Thanks, Lynda.
I have a little bit of real-time follow-up. I asked on Twitter, and Joshua Hudson says that, yes, if you go to the WWC video introducing the modern WebKit API at 4 minutes and 21 seconds, they say everything's there, including fourth-tier LLVM.
That's totally awesome.
Thank you.
Mac listeners, and iOS.
Aces. What was the guy's name? I missed it. Jonathan?
Joshua Hudson.
Joshua.
Thanks, Joshua. Yeah. Get a little extra something special in the mail. Look for it.
Yeah, I've got a t-shirt here. I should just send him a debug t-shirt. So you've been in media for a while, right? I mean, you said you had a background, or at least your degree was in writing journalism?
It's I have this really wacky degree where it's the journalism school I went to at the University of North Carolina. You essentially sort of picked a track, and I picked visual storytelling, and then within that you could do photojournalism, you could do graphic design, and then we had added a sort of third option, which was like multimedia. And being a nerd, I picked multimedia, and one of the things that I really appreciate about not only going to a great liberal arts school, but, you know, the journalism school is it was very sort of multifaceted. And, so I had to take photography classes and I had to take graphic design classes. And, I learned a lot about kind of the broader language of visual media, which I wish that I could kind of execute on more often. I don't give myself an opportunity to maybe take enough photos or like do quote unquote design work, but I do like having a background with that stuff.
Yeah. I was going to say you've worked with a lot of graphics, so
it's true.
I'm trying to lead into at least a couple of articles that you've written. You did a lot of mapping, right? Was that with MSNBC?
We did some mapping stuff at MSNBC. Yeah, it was. A lot of that was Flash based, because at the time, that was how you did sort of like rich interactive map stuff. And then like Google Maps came along, and then now there's all this new stuff with Mapbox and Leaflets and, OpenStreetMap, where, you can do all kinds of crazy stuff. And, one of the projects that I worked on, we worked with, Stamen, which is, a shop here in San Francisco that does a lot of really amazing, infographics and data visualization work. And, one of my favorite projects of theirs, I don't know if you've ever seen this, is, they programmatically created all, these really beautiful, map tiles that, and they have a few of them. One of them looks like it's not just black and white, but it has kind of like a black and white toner out of a Xerox machine from about 1982 kind of a feel to it. The other is this kind of watercolor set. So it's just cool. Like rich, beautiful, Monet kind of, look to it. And someone wrote a little app called Satellite Eyes. Do you guys know this app?
I haven't heard of it, no.
Oh, it's the best. It's called Satellite Eyes, and it's a little app that lives up in the up near the clock in your Mac. What, menu bar? Is that what we call that?
Close enough.
It figures out your geolocation based on your Wi-Fi, and then goes and grabs the map tiles from where you are, and then it'll use these stamen map tiles, and then paints your desktop background with a map of where you are. It's just fun and silly and superfluous, but you should totally make that your background because it's the best thing.
I'm definitely going to check that out.
It's neat. I don't know.
I'm leading up to this. You have a great column from a few years ago and a list apart about Canvas and SVG.
Yeah.
And Canvas fascinates me. For a number of reasons, but yeah, go ahead.
No, what do you find fascinating about it, Kai?
So it came about from the OS X dashboard feature.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is just based on core graphics, like the API they use to program graphics on the Mac.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much just exposed to the web. And it's kind of cool because you can do so much stuff with it. And,
I totally forgot that. I totally forgot that Apple invented Canvas, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was basically
from whole cloth, they just did it.
And it was basically just kind of a web abstraction of their core drawing APIs, right?
Exactly. That's exactly the case. And the funny thing is they did it for dashboard, which is that thing that nobody can remember.
Turned it off.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's the one with all the crazy widgets. Like they did it for that. And it is a terrific idea. And it's got a lot of use from it. And you've got
Let's start this rumor right now. And there may actually be some truth to it, but wasn't before iOS 2.0 was the first iOS you could write third-party apps for, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And there's these like stories and bits of Apple lore, and maybe you guys have even talked about it on the podcast before, about how originally the iOS team wanted third-party apps to be written in HTML and CSS and JavaScript, right?
That gets murky.
Yeah.
Some factions, yes. Some factions, no. But
okay. Well, while
certainly,
we're
certainly the public face was like, hey, you guys go write web apps. That's definitely what got pitched, for sure.
Huh. If you have 6 hours, you can listen to the Nitin Ganatra trilogy, and he'll explain it to you.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Gotcha. So you could almost see how, like, as they were inventing Canvas, you could see how they were like, oh yeah, and then this top secret mobile project that we haven't released yet that only 10 people internally in the company know about, this will be how you build the UI for that, is Canvas.
Well, I don't know if it's been said on the show, but a lot of the early stuff was prototyped with that, and they did have is that true, Renee? They used
a couple tools. I know they used one of the early Macromedia tools too.
They used the Macromedia tools. I think they used that because they had that the contact list was originally done with web stuff. And I think that they tried to implement stuff like stocks and the weather widget and all of that initially using Canvas. And like they basically tried to port the widgets from OS X over to iOS.
Richard Williamson's team.
Yeah, and then they decided that it stank.
the performance wasn't there.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, it just wasn't there yet. And then they told everybody that that's what they told third party developers that was the best way to do it. So who knows?
We don't think the performance is there yet. But
and then
you
we
guys,
got WebOS a year later.
We haven't.
Yeah, we should ask. We should ask Milton. Or
interesting, man. I still miss WebOS. I never actually owned a WebOS phone because like. Why would you if you had the iPhone? Right. But there's so many ideas there that I feel like have escaped a little bit. And I mean, I guess they're coming back into Android since they've hired Tyus Duarte, right?
And we just did a five because it was 5 years ago, a couple 2 or 3 weeks ago that the first webOS phone debuted. So we did a retrospective of it on Vector. And right now it's sitting in LG television sets. Interestingly, but sad.
Interestingly, but sad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the fate of too many things, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way of Amiga and BOS and a whole bunch of other interesting analogy. Things. Yeah.
You know, I used BOS for probably 2 semesters in college.
Oh, really? So hardcore used it. I've only ever played with it. How was it? What was that experience like?
It felt like, so right around the time when this is like mid to late 90s, I started dinking around with like Linux. And I had almost completely wiped out the family's computer when I was 15 or 16, installing like an early version of Red Hat because I thought that it would somehow live next to the Windows 95 that my parents relied on to do their taxes and crap.
So you blew away the bootloader or something.
I came very close to not being able to recover because there was a janky app that would let you sort of repartition the drive a little bit, and it was a bad scene there. But I fixed it, and then I learned so many things.
Well, that's a rite of passage.
Totally.
I don't know. Like on my on my first, just to give you some backup here, we're covering fire. I guess I was 7 or 8, and I loved this game that was on the Apple II, and there was like 5 games on the diskette, and there was a bunch of commands to launch them or I forget what it was, or delete them was definitely one. And I was an idiot and I thought delete said detail. And it was the most detailed game on the disc. I was like, this is awesome. Like it looked super sharp. It was great. So I detailed it, which I was so sad. And I was like, oh, I don't want to tell my dad. I mean, the disc probably cost $5, but when you're that age, you're like,
yeah,
I have destroyed this. Yeah. So you blew away the computer and what, you ended up with BOS on it or what?
Well, just as a quick diversion, I'm a little bit sad that my son is never going to know this experience of what it's like to dig into the internals of the family computer because he's going to have his own, iPad 12 or whatever it's going to be. And
here's the magic. He's going to screw something up that you can't even imagine at this point. You can't wrap your head around what he's going to do.
Holodeck. He's going to mess up your holodeck.
He's going to mess up the holodeck. And then where will we be?
Right. Because there's no way that when our parents were our age now or their kids, that there's no way they could have anticipated me detailing an app or you wiping out the machine. It just wouldn't have happened, right?
Yeah.
So he's going to do something that it's going to traumatize you.
Yeah. Or at least make me scratch my head. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You seem like a pretty calm guy. So.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see.
You'll be befuddled. You will be befuddled.
We'll be befuddled, indeed. So. But. Yeah. So I. You know. When I went to school, I did not buy my first Mac until. Was it the Lombard or the Wall Street G3s? Would that have been 99?
Oh, that's pretty early. I would have guessed you to be a 10.3 kind of guy.
Interesting. No, well,
the Unix web stuff, you know?
Totally. So I went to school, I built my own Windows NT tower that was 3 feet tall and weighed 90 pounds, which is about what I weighed at the time. And and then when I got to school, I started dinking around with Linux a little bit more seriously. And then I discovered B and I was like, this is amazing. It's everything I like about Linux with a cool interface on top of it. And it's going to be the best. It just it didn't have any apps, mm-hmm. and the apps that it had were the ones that B themselves built. So they built their own word processor and they built their own web browser. And but I remember calling the ISP that I was using, because they had not wired the dorms up just yet with mm-hmm. with Ethernet. And so I remember calling whatever ISP I was using. And to get the name of the server that I needed to log into to get an IP address. And they were like, what operating system are you using? And I was like, well, it's kind of like this thing. And the guy on the other line was like super interested. He's like, wow, what's that called? I'm going to go check that out when I get home. And I was like, okay, cool, man.
Oh, that's cool.
It was funny.
That is kind of awesome because usually they're, I mean, even if you call up, it, not these days, but you know, I used to every now and then have to call up with a Mac. And they would basically tell me it wouldn't work. I'm like, no, I really
first open up Internet Explorer, and you're like, oh, okay, well,
yeah, yeah. Like I ended up just lying to them.
Yeah,
so like go to the start menu. I'm like, okay,
yeah, I'm there.
Yeah, so just tell me the steps that you need me to do, and I'll give you the right answer. Like I'm literally sitting in front of like Network Utility, which I believe still sits on the Mac, and it's got like Traceroute and Netstat, and it's. Between that and terminal, like I can diagnose any problem. You just need to fix my thing.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. And the start menu is, I don't really don't need to go to the start menu.
Nope, nobody does.
Yeah. But so what? Again, we're going down the garden path here. But how come you gave up on BOS?
You know, the thing that really practical? Killed it for me was like I had to. Like, I think my computer was booting into three or four different operating systems at this point. But
anytime you're one of those guys. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Was it Cryptomnicon? I think it was Cryptomnicon where, like... Yeah.
I've never heard that said out loud.
Oh, I'm sure I said it wrong. Did I say it wrong?
I don't know. Close enough. I don't care. It's a Slashdot title as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
Cryptonomicon.
Cryptonomicon. I knew there was an extra syllable in there. We'll say Cryptonomicon.
Close enough. Who cares?
Yeah. You know that book that Neil Stephenson wrote in the mid-90s that's kind of coming true with like Bitcoin and crap? That's the book I'm talking about. I think there was a point in there where one of the protagonists is like booting into multiple operating systems to, and I was like, that was me, man. the thing that killed it for me with B was just like, I couldn't print. And there were two printers in the world that worked and I didn't own them. And so like, you know, when you're in college, you're like writing your papers. And so inevitably I would like try to write my paper in their like janky word processor. And then I would like save it to a disk and reboot into Windows and like just to print my paper out. And that was so stupid.
I understand it. That was one of the two kind of major technical reasons that they didn't go up to B, that Apple didn't buy B. Printing was not a thing effectively on B, and it was only single user.
Hmm. Oh, interesting.
Huh. And I don't mean single user in terms of like you get multiple users on like, I mean it in the Unix sense, right? Like stuff would run in other processes with different permissions. Like everything was only one permission. So
right. Yeah. But I really liked B, and I think, you know, there's still a couple of like, There's some project that I can't remember the name of that is trying to emulate the B APIs.
Yeah.
There's something like that for like the next OS 2 and you know, stuff like that. And I love that there are people out there in the world that are doing those things because
Haiku is the B one.
Haiku, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I ran that in an emulator just to see what it was about, and I was like, yeah, you know, there seems like they're getting it right. They've got the little wacky windowing scheme with the little yellow tab, and
Were great.
They were great. Yeah.
You know what? The icons were amazing. That isometric style is.
Yeah. Like,
you could ship that today, and it would still look fresh.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. I bet it would look really cool on a mobile device too.
Like, probably.
You know, a B theme on your Android device. Somebody's probably done it.
Probably got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or if not, somebody get to it. I say to the audience of avid Apple users.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But, can I ask you guys a question?
Yeah, shoot.
So I was having a very terse, just because it was over Twitter, back and forth with Paul Ford. Do you guys know Paul Ford, F-Train on Twitter?
I recognize his name. We've not met. No.
Super, super, super smart guy. He's one of these. He's been writing on the web and about the web and about technology and the internet and its impact on things for a long time. And and he sort of posited this idea that I was musing about how optimistic I was. This thing that I was talking about earlier about how like, you know, the language of the web, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, Canvas, SVG, all of that stuff is becoming more native and to the point where, you can almost build apps that feel native on the web, and you can certainly integrate them into native apps. And Paul broke my heart when he said, you know, the real problem here is that the web page as we know it is dying, and the notion of a web page is not going to exist for a whole lot longer, and all of that stuff is getting sort of consumed and subsumed by apps. And
do you believe that?
Well, I don't know, but it made me sad because Paul's really smart, and he knows his shit. And when he says something like that, it generally turns out to be true. So I'm wondering what you guys think about this, about like, and we've already seen a version of that starting to happen, right? Where like so much of the, of what we would call the web is locked into Facebook. And, and even things like, you know, you could even make the case that something like Twitter is a little bit not in the spirit of, you know, the web that I grew up loving, and like centralized this communications platform.
We had CompuServe and Prodigy and AOL that gated the web.
Yeah, but those all predate the actual web that I think Jim's talking about, right? Like
a little
all
bit.
Of those were gated communities, and then we had an open web for, I don't know, 25 years. And
unless
now
it's a cycle though, like it gates and then people break out, then they want to gate it again, then they break out again.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know, the wonderful thing about like the open web is, as old timers call it, is that like, you know, it's super accessible, anyone can get into it. But it's also like the terrible thing is like it's kind of a bad user experience. It's usually pretty ugly. Like it is pretty fragile in some places. Whereas like Facebook, for all of its faults, like all the good designers work there, and like it. You know, I don't particularly love their aesthetic, I will say that, but like it works for the billion people that use it.
It's a packaged internet experience for people for whom the general web is intimidating or inaccessible.
I like the way you put that, Rene. I'm going to steal that from Dan.
Yeah, he does that. It's annoying.
Yeah, it's annoying. So I don't know. Like I don't have an answer to this, but I'm curious. Like
so. I mean, I would say that I think a lot of people who write native apps are scared that the web is going to take them over.
Interesting.
I don't know. Maybe it's a healthy fear. I do take your point in that if everything's locked up in Facebook and Facebook has an app, who cares about the web, right?
Yeah.
And I think Twitter, to me, I very rarely use the Twitter website. It's almost by accident that I use it.
Right.
I don't necessarily think that means the web's going away. I certainly don't think that like a lot of news sites or a lot of reading on the web requires what the web is best at, right? Which is clicking through and exploring and landing on some weird page. And apps don't do that. And when they do that, it's because they've just stuck a web view in their thing.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like,
but you don't get to meander in an app. An app is a very direct experience. And I think there will always be a demand for, I don't want to say wasting time, but I mean, you know what it's
that's
like reading
analogy.
The web.
Right? It's like the apps are these big, beautiful cities, and then the web is all the stuff in between them.
Well,
so
you get to go exploring. You end up in the middle of nowhere, like – that's
the
awesome.
Lands,
whatever, you know, like you, I don't, maybe you start on like Talking Points memo and you click on one of those awful ads at the bottom, like 18.
You hate those
eight,
ads,
oh my God. I really hate them. I think it's the first time it's come up on the show, but man, I hate those ads.
On behalf of web publishers everywhere, I apologize.
I love Talking Points memo. They are some of the smartest people. They need copy editing and they need to change their ads.
Yeah. I think about once a week on Twitter, you're fetching about the
I'm sorry
ads at the bottom of
well because they're always so ridiculous. And you know what I hate myself because I click on them every now and then. It's like 18 people we don't believe exist. I'm like,
the 10 Batman villains that need to be in the next movie,
yeah, whatever it is. There's every now and then there's one that gets me and I'm like, I'm angry at myself, and I take it out on the otherwise completely excellent Talking Points memo.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what the web is about. following dumbness.
But to your point, I mean, if you're in Twitter or you're in Facebook, or even if you're in Google Maps and there's a link to a restaurant or to a story that someone shared, the minute you click that, you're back in the open web.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Guy, I think you maybe made an interesting point in sort of a roundabout way, which is the reason that that Talking Points Memo has to have those horrible ads at the bottom of their page is because another of the things that the web is not historically very good at is letting people make money on being on the web. And
that's true.
So we have all of these like horrible tricks to kind of hack it, and we kind of borrow metaphors from old media, and we have this really sort of terrible ad system that's managed to kind of dominate most of digital publishing. But you know, the web needs to invent a way to let people make money if it wants to exist, and that's a solution. So, that's a problem that apps solve really, really well.
Well, I mean, do they? I don't know how many apps you can. I don't think your ad revenue will be exceeded by your app revenue.
No, that's certainly true.
But that's, again, I don't think. I mean, I'm sure in some cases yes, in some cases no. So I hear a lot that publishing needs to figure out a way to get money.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I think the actual, or at least the flip side of the problem, is that people need to figure out that they need to pay for quality content.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason that you subscribe to the New Yorker. Guess what? It's awesome.
Yeah.
You exactly. Barely do that for apps anymore.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a double whammy going on here, right? Like, I don't think it's necessarily fair to blame publishers for failing to make money. And again, I rant on the TPM ads.
But, plenty of publishers have shot themselves in the foot, just by the way. Like, I'm not here to defend the publishers of the world and all of the horrible decisions they've made over the past two decades. But
yeah, proceed. No, but you know where I'm coming from. I think people need to understand that, like, well, I'm going to have to pay in some way if I want the good content. And, you know, ads, are you paying with your attention?
Mm-hmm.
And if the ads are obnoxious, you know, maybe some money would work.
Like television, like I remember, because the Canadian ads are a little bit different, but I went to the U.S. All it was ads for lawyers, you know, to sue people and health insurance and stuff. We have healthcare, so we don't get those ads. And it was they were really bad ads, and it made me not want to watch television. And I think Guy and I have talked about this before, but I pay for Mad Men on iTunes because I don't want to watch it with ads. It just feels different.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I pay for it every time.
Yeah, it is weird to watch. Like, why is it weird to watch Mad Men in particularly with ads? Like,
because I usually watch a lot of HBO and there's no ads, you know. And then on iTunes, it doesn't have it. And once you've caught up with it with no ads on Netflix or iTunes, then if you try to watch the new season with ads, it feels different.
Yeah, but I think the point of Mad Men is that they are making ads. That's the entire thing. So you'd think that sprinkling ads every now and then through the show might actually work. But
oh, they should do ads, but in the era of Mad Men.
Exactly. Like, I wonder if they made 60s era ads, you know, for Suzuki or, you know, like Subaru rather. And, you know, like for modern brands, like imagine what an Apple ad made by Don Draper would look like. Like,
I swear to God, I would watch those.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a shame. Here's the I feel like someone thing. Has to have had that.
I would pay to watch those.
Yeah.
Give me a show with those ads in it and I'd be so happy. Like, I will give you money for that.
Yeah. You know that like Matthew Weiner went to where is it AMC? Is that where we watched that show?
AMC.
And was like, you know, we got to figure out a way to do this. And they were like, we don't have the resources. We wouldn't have the resources in a million years to be able to do that. Go make your silly show. But this open web question is one that old farts like myself and my cohort sort of. I don't know. We wring our hands about it a lot. And I feel like no one under the age of 30 gives a shit about whether or not the open web is going to exist because they're too busy being millionaires working for Facebook and Twitter. And,
well, I mean, you're in San Francisco, so I don't think anybody under 20, that's a pretty broad generalization.
They're playing Candy Crush. I'm not worried about the web.
You're right. But I think they take it for granted. It's like you and I worrying if, you know, the municipal water supply is going to be okay.
Interesting. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I think it's just something that they just
like a
see.
Utility.
Yeah. But I do, I mean, I don't know what the demographics were for the SOPA stuff that went down in the States. Was that people our age or did younger people also get in on that?
Yeah, but you know, I feel like those are two different things. Like there's one, you know,
One's open, like slow and insidious, access. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, like open access, but even open access to the internet that connects us is one thing. Like, I think when I say open web, I mean like the web that you view through your browser, not necessarily through an app, or through a service like Facebook. Like that's the part that I feel like, and a lot of people, again, they're all like, you know, Anil Dash actually has written very eloquently about this. He wrote a series called The Web We Lost that I think definitely be
smart guy, and that's worth a read.
Definitely a smart guy. And he wrote some follow-ups to it about like how it came to be that way, which was like a video series that he did at Harvard, and then thinking about how we get it back. And I, you know, I'm glad that smart people like Anil are talking about that. I guess I'm a bit of a pessimist that we're going to I feel like I'm personally in a weird space where like I'm super excited about the kind of convergence of web and native and the fact that like we can make web pages that feel more like native apps and we can make apps that pull from the web and we can build platforms that kind of that bridge both of those things. And you know, this is my current job. This is currently what I'm doing. And so I'm super excited by that, but I also still feel like, and part of the reason that we feel like we need to have a native app is because it's easier to monetize. It's easier to convince people to subscribe to this thing than it is to, subscribe to a website. Now that's changing a little bit, but, it's still easier to get people to buy an app.
No, I'd agree.
But you know, I still feel some angst about like maybe Paul Ford's right. Maybe the web page, as we think about it, as the atomic unit of the web, is going to cease to exist in 5-10 years.
So I'm not entirely convinced by that argument. But let's take it. Let's just accept it. Two questions, I guess. One, what needs to change in order to preserve the open web? And B, is that worth doing? Like purely academic style questions. Like I have my own opinions, but you know what I mean? Like what do we do to keep it? And then is that really what we want?
Yeah. I feel like I'm going to answer the second part of your question first, and the first part of your answer I'm going to ignore. Because I don't have an answer to the first part. But is it worth it? I feel like it is, because I feel like we could conceivably get to a point where I'm not a fan of sort of slippery slope arguments, but I do sort of feel like it's getting harder and harder to compete against things like Facebook and Google and stuff, and the open web and the only people that are really sort of championing this are this like Mozilla, and God love Mozilla, and because they sort of kept that flag flying during the dark days of Internet Explorer and stuff. I mean, who knows what all any of this would look like if we only had IE, but like the Mozilla version of the open web, where like you can download all of your data and you can set permissions as to who has access to all of that. I think it's important that it be able to coexist with these giant multi-billion-dollar corporations, because I don't feel like they have our best interests at heart. I really don't feel like Facebook has my best interests at heart. Facebook cares about me at all. No. I don't feel like,
and that's not an indictment necessarily of them. It's the way the world works.
Yeah,
giant corporations look after themselves.
They've got their
job, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Which includes Apple, by the way.
Yeah.
I just want to be clear. Like, I don't want to seem like I'm just crapping on you know.
Any company sufficiently large is indistinguishable from evil.
Exactly.
That's a bit harsh, but yeah, it's self-interest.
Well, no, it's just eventually their interests will diverge with a significant number of, like, not, it won't with everybody, but there will always be some people whose interests diverge from theirs.
Sure. Yeah.
And here's the interesting difference between Apple and Google and Facebook, for instance, is I feel like this is a point that gets written about a lot, and particularly in the sort of Apple partisan camp. I know that, like, Gruber makes this point a lot, where, like, yep, for Apple, his name's John Gruber. I'll send you his website later. Nice. But he talks about like when you buy a device from Apple, like, that's where Apple makes their money, right?
Right.
And so Apple doesn't care about me and the singular Jim Ray iPhone owner, but it does, like, it cares about making an experience that I'm happy with. And part of that, mm-hmm, and part of what they sell is that they don't make their money by selling my user data. And I value that. And so, right, that's great. Whereas, you know, the Facebooks and the Googles, and increasingly this is the kind of model of how you make money on the internet these days, is like, can you conceive of a more sort of cynical business model than make a list of all of your friends, give it to me so that I can sell them ads?
That is,
like,
it's mind-boggling.
The kids these days, they look at me and they think I'm just an old man who's cranky. Yeah. But, like, I can remember a time when that was considered cynical, not just business as usual.
No, that is, it's over the top. Like, if you lay out the business like that, that's bananas. Like, why?
And that's obviously an oversimplification. But,
well, here's the thing. I mean, the reason that I it's not like I hold it over them, but that I accept, you know, stuff like Facebook or Twitter, all that, is that I don't think Zuckerberg set out to capture a list of people's friends lists so he could make money off it. He did his Facebooky thing, maybe with some other weird ideas in mind, but it's now become a business that does that. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think you fall. I don't even think that forgive me for this one. No. Well, yeah, Sergey and Larry for sure. I don't think they meant to get that creepy. They're just
that was all Eric Schmidt.
They're poorly socialized, maybe. Yeah, there's some creepy shit there. But I mean, and this is a bit of a stretch, but I don't even think oil companies are out to cause wars and make the world all screwed up. It's just the way that it's the way the business goes. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, it's the way the world is. Absolutely.
It's the pressures of the business and their motivations and their interests. And I think you really need to look out for that, which is what you're saying with, like, when Apple sells your device, they want you to have a good experience because that's what they're selling. For Google or Facebook, that's not what they're selling. They have a different, they have different interests. Yeah, but you need to be aware of the interests of the company that you're interacting with.
It's a horrible analogy, but it always feels to me like when I buy an iPhone, we went out to dinner and it's Dutch. When I use the product of Google's, it feels like they bought me a lobster dinner and then are sitting at me leering at the end of it.
That's disgusting.
I think I actually kind of like that analogy.
Yeah.
it's a slippery slope of hideous compromise.
Yeah, exactly.
So you fear, I mean, maybe fear is a bit strong, but you're worried that the open web can't compete against a bunch of these giant corporate conglomerates, right? Or conglomerates, corporate mega things, right?
And it's also that, like, the things that I value are also going to be increasingly not viable.
Right.
So here's an example. I've taken thousands of photos since my son was born in February, and very explicitly they're not on Facebook, they're not on Twitter, they're not sort of out there in places where I am, because I don't have a good way of kind of walling off these sort of like very personal, intimate photos, but I do have them on Flickr, and I have them on Flickr. And if we're, if I have checked you as a friend or a family member, then you can go to Flickr, and I try to upload at least a photo a day of Theo. And so you, so that, you know, my family, they're, kind of all over the country. And so, you know, everyone can see him. The problem is I don't know anyone on Flickr anymore. I have a handful of people that I have to kind of poke and prod and say like, hey, please come look at these photos of my Ken Flickr. Now I know that if I uploaded a daily photo of Theo to Instagram, it'd be huge. I'd have 10,000 followers because he's literally the cutest kid in the world. Yeah. And everyone would just be goo goo gaga and would be hearting all over the place. But I am uncomfortable with my relationship with Instagram to the point where I don't continue to have an account.
Because of Facebook?
Because of Facebook. And I don't know. I felt like the whole deal there would just felt sort of scummy to me. It's wrapped up in all my shit about like Silicon Valley and the people that it produces out here. And I kind of feel like Kevin Systrom's a bit of a turd and so like, I just don't want to reward them with like an intimate picture into my life. So this is the bargain that I've made is that like I upload photos to Flickr, but no one sees them.
Right.
And you know, that's what I fear that we're losing is we're losing the ability. Like no one yet, like Flickr, when they came out in 2004, they had one of the first and they still have the best sort of social graph management where like it's not terribly complicated. You say you're like, I want to, establish a relationship with this person, and then I can mark that they're a friend or that they're family. And then every photo, every album, every interaction that you have within that system is built upon that so that you can say, like, this album over here, everyone can see this album over there. Only friends can see this album over here. My family can see. And that is super powerful and interesting. And they got it right miraculously the first time they did it. Yeah. No one has bothered even copying that, and I think we're poorer for it because
it seems like it's a good idea, right? I mean, it's a great idea. Three levels, right? It's like family. I mean, define that however you want, but you know, people closest to you,
sure,
friends, your pals, and then just the world, right? Like broadcast, yeah.
And you can, and then it's up to me to figure out the overlapping circles of who gets what. Mm-hmm. And like we're on Facebook now. I'm sure, I don't have a Facebook, so I can't. Which is the douchiest thing in the world to say. It's 15 years ago we used to say I don't have a TV. I don't know what level of levers I would have to pull and push in order to make sure that like only the right people saw photos. But even if I could figure out the privacy setting, I don't trust Facebook with.
Yeah, I mean, you must have seen
data.
You saw Mike's talk, right?
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Mike Montero for the people out there. I forget the name of the talk.
How design ruined the world?
Yeah, great talk.
Great talk. You got to link that up in the show notes.
I'll find that. Oh my god. Mike's an ace when it comes to doing this stuff. Total jerk in real life.
He's a terrible person.
he's the worst.
He does give a good keynote.
So his example was basically social circles gone wrong on Facebook, right? Where I believe a young woman is out to her friends but not her family, and the UI of Facebook totally screws it up and bad things end up happening.
Yeah. And if they had the right people in the room when they were making that design decision, this is another one of these like San Francisco, Silicon Valley kind of things. Like Twitter just yesterday released their diversity report, or rather their lack of diversity report, where 90% of their engineers are white and something like 80% are male, or maybe I have that reversed, but you know, it's like a staggering number of these high profile companies around here have engineering staffs that are privileged white men. And as a privileged white man, I'm outraged by that.
Yeah. I will say this, and I don't mean to necessarily jump to the defense of Twitter although that's basically what I'm going to do. they were kind enough to host a singleton thing to watch the WWDC keynote. And before that, one of the speakers, and I'm going to forget her name, but she was promoting women in technology and saying that Twitter has a program to diversify, and they encourage their employees to go and give talks at any kind of conferences and be engaged and try to bring more women in. You're right. I think, because I saw that report, definitely lack of diversity. And I'm sure there's Twitter people that are listening now. I don't know.
Google's report was no better, and Apple hasn't even put one out yet, I don't think. But they're
right.
They're planning on it.
Yeah, I think it's a systemic thing. Yes, you're right that Twitter is in that box, but I do think that people are kind of paying more attention to this. Hopefully,
I think people are definitely paying a lot more attention to it. And I think. A lot of that is because there's been a very active group of people, a very vocal group of people mm-hmm. that are really putting feet to the fire about some of this stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that should totally continue. Don't get me wrong. I just wanted to give like that little anecdote that
sure.
I don't. It's not this stone faced wall of Twitter being like screw it, we're all white men. I think there's internal struggle probably in all of these places.
Problem no one's trying to fix is worse than a problem that they are trying to fix.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I will anxiously await these diversity reports in 2 to 5 years to see
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. If nothing ever changes and it's like, well.
Right. Exactly. If the numbers look the same let's say 5 years, then we know that we've got a serious problem.
Yeah. So that's actually been a problem for, I bring up this podcast almost every single time, the Script Notes podcast, which covers, script writing for Hollywood. They've been doing diversity reports for years now. And apparently script writing is what you'd expect. It's like, it's us, or, you know, basically people like us, very few women and effectively zero people of color or any minority. And it hasn't changed year over year over year. So the Script Notes guys were being like, they were upset.
Yeah. And, you know, and like, again, going back to Hanlon's razor, like doesn't have to be some cabal that is, you know, pulling all of the levers in the background to making sure that, and it's not just tech companies, obviously, like every industry deals with this, you know, these diversity issues. You can see how it happens. It's like, you know, if you are a privileged white male who kind of has the luxury of him having a little bit of time early in his life to figure things out and maybe you get to have some success, then what are you going to do? You're going to hire your friends. You're going to hire the people that you know. And, it takes real work to create diversity. Like, you have to look at the numbers. You have to make a commitment to say like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to promote people out and, we're going to go talk at some of these conferences that tries to get, more women and more people of color into, these various industries. But then you still have to hire them at the end of the day. Like, you know, Facebook can give all the money it wants to Black Girls Who Code, but like it needs to hire some Black Girls Who Code.
Right. Oh, well, I think it goes back to, what's the razor? It's not Occam's razor. Like the never attribute to malice. Hanlon's razor. Yeah. I think that goes to certainly this question, to the question of corporate interests and to a lot of things. I think that's just a good way of approaching life is that if you, if you assume people are out to do evil, it's going to be a hard way to get through life and you're never going to be able to build bridges and get along with people, right?
That's a hard way to live.
Yeah. At the same time, when you're applying Hanlon's razor, it's because you're doing it to a situation that's bad, right? Like no matter what's happened, like the result is bad. So, you know, it's worth looking into at least.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So HTML5,
problems
awesome.
Left and right here. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Again, I mean, we started the show as saying that we don't talk about tech, and we've been trying.
I swear to God,
listeners, I swear we've been trying. I have studiously avoided getting into the San Francisco issue with you.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The whole Valley stuff. Well, because it's come up a couple of times, and I'm like, I'm not going to bite.
And we should avoid it because it makes me cranky. But
Yeah. It's been coming up, and it's 2 hours in, and we could go like another 8 hours. I'm sure totally. We could go 8 hours on that. Yeah.
You know what I did have to do? I did have to stop talking about it on Twitter because I was actually losing friends, and not just like people were. It's not just that, like, I don't care if you want to follow me on Twitter or not, but it was creating
friends were getting angry at you.
Yeah, not even angry, but it was just sort of creating like awkward social situations, and I still believe that, like, first of all, like, a couple of things were happening. First of all, like, people were just like, if you hate San Francisco so much, Jim, why don't you just leave? And it's like, I love it here. And I, like,
San Francisco is a wonderful city, one of my favorite places on earth, effectively. I love going there. Yeah.
It's certainly not without its problems.
No,
but I also feel like I, you know, I help to work, like, my wife and I, we volunteer, and like, we moved here because we wanted to start a family here, and we feel like it's a place where, that shares a lot of the values that we have.
Sure.
And all of that stuff. And of course, lots of people feel that way. And a lot of those people feel that way right now. And so they're all coming to town too. And it creates, anytime you have a situation like that, it creates,
some market pressure, right?
Yeah. Well, not just market pressure, but you know, there's just like social issues and pressure and things like that too. So I've tried to stop kind of, sticking my eye and like, sticking my thumb in the eye of this, this problem, because like I did spend a full year just being angry about.
I loved so many of those articles you sent.
And they're gonna, and you know, new ones keep coming out, and of course I read them all, and I still get angry, I think that when I do sit down I do get a chance to sit down with friends of mine here in town who are very thoughtful about these things. And, you know, we sit around, like, usually around election time, we try to have like a civics roundtable and, you know, just kind of talk about the issues of the day and talk about like, what are we going to vote on and, those kinds of things. I think it's important.
We should explain to, listeners outside of California that you have a very direct democracy down there. So,
oh my God. And it is
issue
probably
by issue
the worst
sense
feature
to,
of California.
Yeah. I think it's screwed up. It's broken, but
absolutely.
It's like one of those ideas. It sounds like great on paper.
Yeah.
Hey, let's vote on everything. And then it's like, no, that's just dumb.
That's
can't
protect
do that.
You from the tyranny of majority.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's two things. It's like, do you want higher taxes? No. Do you want every dog to be walked for free by a city worker? Yes. Yeah. Like, that's just, you can't do that.
Right. Yeah. So, and it does. We're sort of a poster child for the kind of bad legislation that it creates. But I don't know. We're going down yet another garden path.
But. Well, we're doing what we actually want to do, but we got to, you know, there's people listening.
Hey guys.
So I tech culture in San Francisco. You're way more connected to the sort of web side of stuff than I am. Is it healthy or unhealthy? Like, do you have a – I mean, I'm going to ask you to sum it up, like, quickly, which is dumb. It's the dumbest
thing.
This question is dumb. Everybody, let's just accept that. How do you feel about the culture down there?
Well, I'm going to not answer your question and instead answer a slightly different question, which
– Good, because my question was awful. So
no, it wasn't. It's a good question and one that we could talk about for
too
many
open-ended.
Hours.
Yeah.
But I, you know, you mentioned kind of like the web culture and that you're not as connected to it. And I think one of the things that has been interesting to watch, and this gets back to the maybe what we were talking about earlier with like this notion of kind of the open web and will web pages even exist in 5 years, is a lot of tech culture here is not concerned with the web in the way that it was during the first boom.
Interesting.
And I say the first boom implying that we are currently in the middle of the second boom, of course. But
yeah, I think that's very hard to argue that we're not at this point.
Boy, howdy. But you know, like you could show up in San Francisco. Well, I wasn't here, but I know plenty of people who were, and you know, we talk about this a lot. But like, you could show up in San Francisco in 1997 and kind of bullshit your resume into, I know HTML, and you could be working a very handsomely paid job by the end of the week, and
some of the greats probably did.
You could sell broadcast.com to Yahoo.
Yeah, you could sell broadcast.com. Exactly. You know, I remember Jeff Veen, who is someone that I've got a huge amount of respect for and have for a long time.
Huge name.
Yeah, and I've been very lucky to get to know him a little bit here in town. And he has this great story about he essentially did just that. Like, he showed up in San Francisco or maybe he was here already, but he did a very clever thing, which was he applied to Wired, I think even as an intern, and instead of just like sending a Word copy of his resume, he actually made a web page for his resume. And this was like 95.
Yeah.
And sent them a link. And that just blew people's mind. and they were like, wow, we got to get this guy. Yeah, exactly. And
it's like, it seems like a no-brainer now, but at the time,
yeah, of course. But here's the thing. I feel like it's gone the other direction. And you know, this is all going to make sense in some sort of point I'm trying to make here, where it's like, you know, and I got sort of a frontline view of this at Mule a little bit. And I'm getting kind of a sort of second and third hand view of this in other ways, but like the web isn't cool because the web, you know, you're not going to IPO with a website, and you're not going to, certainly not in the same way. And it was very unhealthy in the late 90s, obviously, right, when pets.com was worth billions of dollars. But it's all about apps in a lot of ways. And I feel like apps, like, if in the same way that in 1997, if you knew HTML and some JavaScript, if you show up in town today and say that you are, and you can write an Android or an iOS app, then, you know, you're making, six figures and you've got, tuna steak for lunch every day. And
I'll see you tomorrow then, man. I'm on my way. Get right, out of plan.
Exactly. And so I think that transition has happened.
Yeah.
And I think that it seems like there is a lot. It's not that there's more money. It's just the money is happening a little bit differently, it seems like. Mm-hmm. Like gunning for the IPO doesn't seem to be as much of a thing as gunning to sell to Facebook.
That's rough.
Definitely seems to be more of the end goal.
I don't think either of those are healthy.
Or Yahoo's doing like what, two a week now?
Yeah. I mean, they're making acquisitions left and right. For Yahoo, it seems more of kind of a little bit more desperate. For Facebook, it's maybe a different kind of desperation in that they don't want to be the next Yahoo.
Well, Apple always wants to to obsolete themselves. So if iPod sales goes down, they want to have an iPhone ready, where Zuckerberg has so much money and they haven't been able to make another Facebook that he just wants to buy anything that looks like it'll take attention away, like Instagram or WhatsApp.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Instagram's a perfect example of that. And I haven't quite figured out how WhatsApp or Oculus Rift fit into that, but
WhatsApp is where people are spending, like, young kids were going to WhatsApp instead of going to Facebook, so he was losing that attention.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, in 5 years, I'll be doing it all in VR. So
yeah, I mean, if I had billions of dollars, I might also just buy Oculus. Hey, screw it.
He's sitting in guy's closet. Where's Oculus? I left it here somewhere.
Yeah. Just whatever. Buy a Carmack building and just make him go do stuff. That's fine. Not a problem. So are you hopeful?
Oh, I'm,
you or know, are you troubled by the, here's the future of the web and all of this
so,
stuff?
So people like follow me on Twitter and they're just like, wow, that Jim Ray is a really cranky guy. And then occasionally I get a chance
really?
To
I think you
in real life. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like you and I, we know each other in real life. And
I guess so. I don't. Yeah.
And,
maybe.
And we know that each other, like we both know how incredible we are. And so, and
actually thinking about it, I probably sound like a total asshole on Twitter. Now that I think about it.
It's endearing, guy.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm surprised to hear that about you. So yeah, so
no, so I'm generally a very optimistic person, and and particularly about tech stuff. And you know, I make jokes all the time. It's just like, oh my god, if I have to deal with like this crappy implementation, I'm just going to give it all up and go farm pigs out somewhere, which I still might do. But
I've worked on a pig farm, so we can talk.
Oh, yeah, well that'll be next week's podcast.
Yeah.
But so I'm generally pretty optimistic about this stuff. Which means that I'm constantly being disappointed. But I do think that that like this convergence that we've been talking about mostly portends good things for the web. I think that it means that that we'll be able to make things that if aren't If the web page does actually die, we'll be making things that are similar to web pages, those things will be existing in other places. They won't just be existing in browsers, but they'll be existing in apps and on devices and on wearable things maybe. And we'll take the sort of nascent notions of like responsive design that are, you know, feels old hat at this point, but I still feel like is very, is like we've only really scratched the surface about like what responsive really means. Because like there's going to be a whole, like right now, responsive just means, that, you know, does it like squish down on my phone? But you know,
but in theory, like a media query is completely powerful. Like you can do so much.
And pretty soon the context is going to go beyond like screen size.
Right.
You know, it's gonna, like we're going to want data fed into the light bulbs in our houses and then the things that we wear once we figure out what that UX needs to be. And so I'm generally optimistic that like Facebook is not necessarily going to be able to own all of this stuff and that a certain amount of openness is going to need to continue to exist and that we're going to be able to thrive there. And create really interesting things here in the future. So I'll say, yes, I'm an optimist.
So, I mean, maybe what happens is that, the parts that make the web magic, which I think is the exploration, I mean, beyond the technology and the, you know, the typography and the HTML and all of that, I think it's the, just the digging through all of this content generated by different people, like the wandering in an intellectual landscape is effectively or either pseudo intellectual or really dumb landscape. depends what links you click on. I don't want to oversell it, but I think that sort of wandering is part of the magic of the web, and maybe that can be recreated in other ways if your fears do come to pass. I'm not sold, but like you said, smart people do worry about this. So,
and I think that you know that sort of wandering serendipitous aspect that was certainly so new when the first time you saw a web browser has gotten to be exhausting. Like how many browser windows and within those windows, how many tabs do you have open right now?
Don't.
It's more than you could possibly. You have more tabs open than there are stars in the sky, and like everyone does, and everyone's exhausted by it constantly, and I think that you know, there's a really interesting challenge for some people smarter than me to go out and figure out how we solve the exhaustion of the never-ending scroll,
right,
and the never-ending feed, because like you know the social media era of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, you know, they created these never-ending feeds that are just killing us by a thousand cuts. And I do think, and maybe Facebook and Twitter is going to figure this out, but I'm guessing perhaps not. I think there's like an opportunity, and I can't believe I'm using this word, but an opportunity for disruption to actually help us sort through some of that, right, and do it in an intelligent way. I would love to see some of that, because like it can be overwhelming. It can be hard to manage.
Oh, it is. I mean, I read a lot. I really read a lot.
Yeah.
And I can't read it all.
Yeah. No. I've got, like, and you want to. You're just like,
I do.
Like,
yeah.
All of the internet is there and I can just consume all of it. Hello?
That was.
I think we dropped by for a second.
Oh. Just as we got good, Jim got all heated. Like, all I heard was all of the internet, and then it cut out.
I just thought what I said was maybe really profound, but
it was that it was so deep that the internet cut us off.
Took the breath from the
cut us off the knees.
Oh my stars and God, he's right.
You are a good Southern boy.
20 some years of practice, so
good man.
We may have exhausted everything that I've talked way beyond even ability to talk at this point. So I've mostly been bullshitting for at least the last hour.
So we should
probably end it here.
That's what it is. Yeah, we got to wrap this up. But no, you haven't. We could do this for hours. All of the good stuff happens when it's like when you're not doing the homework of like, so what did you work on?
Yeah,
and you start getting into to the conversation. That's always fun.
Cool.
Is it South Carolina or North Carolina that has the mustard and vinegar-based barbecue sauce?
Okay. I thought that we were going to a place that was going to compromise our friendship. So, but this is a straightforward question. Yeah. South Carolina has the mustard-based vinegar or mustard-based barbecue sauce.
Yeah. It's mustard and vinegar and a bunch of like paprika, some other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So. It is, it's not my favorite barbecue sauce, but
sure.
You know, it does its thing. I prefer the Piedmont style barbecue myself. It's,
Racist? Is that because that's your region or what? Like, are you just like
racist?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm certainly kind of racist, but
you know what I mean? Like, is that just because it's like you're a clan and you're a people and like that's your barbecue sauce, so you're going to crap on the other barbecue sauce or
it basically is my So you know one of the great things about and one of the reasons that I think barbecue is America's great culinary contribution is because we have so many distinct regional variations.
Yeah, I started doing research and wow, yeah. Cool man. And the sauces don't line up with the states at all. Like,
oh no, yeah,
it's cool. Yeah.
Oh, and within a state, you'll have multiple regions. Like in North Carolina, we have Piedmont, which is sort of centered around Lexington and kind of in the middle of the state. And then we have Eastern, and there's a slight difference in the sauces, but it's also in Eastern North Carolina, they split the pig in half and they barbecue the whole pig. In Central Western North Carolina, they mostly focus on the shoulder.
I'm
partial to the shoulder myself, but I do appreciate roasting a whole pig, if only because you know they're using a whole animal, so I like that.
We've spit roasted a few pigs in our for like bachelor parties and other kind of things, yeah. And we build a few times we've actually not even rented the spit roaster. We've built the spit like caveman style out of
Excellent.
Wood. And like, yeah, well, it's dumb. If you're hungry, it's going to take a long time to cook that pig, but it's satisfying, you know?
Yeah, it's satisfying. And you spend a whole day and half a night doing it. And
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like,
take your time.
Yeah. No better way to spend a weekend.
Yeah. Like a good friend of mine, old friend of mine, for his honeymoon, and I have no idea how he talked his wife into this, but he did a barbecue mecca, basically.
Nice.
He's Canadian, and he drove down along the Mississippi, just stopping at juke joints and like
oh, wow.
getting, getting various barbecue.
That is pretty awesome. So yeah. You know, Memphis on down into Mississippi and Louisiana and
type
like
thing.
That.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's a good way to do it.
I'm kind of jealous now. I didn't, and because at the time he explained it to me, I'm like, okay, that's crazy. I don't know what you're doing. Then I did a stint in Houston, and I had some barbecue. Ooh, turned out it was pretty good.
Yeah, right.
So. So like, I mean, barbecue up here, not a thing.
No,
it's garbage. Actual barbecue? Holy crap, that is some good stuff.
And I actually have the same problem on the West Coast. Like West Coast barbecue. And they try really hard. God love them. You know, as we say to ourselves, bless their little hearts. they really do try. And here I think as I was saying earlier that like, you know, one of the great contributions and one of the reasons that barbecue is one of the great contributions to the culinary landscape is because we have all these regional variations. And I think that in order to make good barbecue, you have to have an opinion about what makes good barbecue.
Yes.
And I think the problem with West Coast barbecue is because there's not as much of a tradition, or because the tradition exists largely comes out of Mexico and South America. The folks that are doing it here don't necessarily have an opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And so they're just like, oh yeah, we'll do a pork shoulder and we'll, you know, throw in a couple of different kinds of ingredients and we'll call that a sauce. And I need you to have an opinion about it in order for me to think that it's going to be good. Yeah. And, so
I think it's probably like, Californian food or like tacos or Tex-Mex kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Up here in Montreal. No, forget it. Like people can do the recipe, but they don't have a real opinion, you know?
Yeah.
So. And not there's plenty of good food up here. Just not that kind of stuff.
I know. I got to come up there and I got to experience some of this.
Anytime you and the family want to come up, I'll love to hang out.
Right. I'm going to make it to Singleton one of these days. So
one day. Yeah.
When is it this year?
October 10th.
October 10th. You know, that's right after we launched the magazine. So,
So Jim, where do we find you?
Probably the best place to find me. Oh God. You know, after all my hemming and
just bitching about the Twitter.
I don't actually have a personal website. Honestly, like
you have your own personal app. You can download the Jim Ray app.
You can download the Jim Ray app. And, if you Google my name, you're probably going to get my Twitter profile, and that's probably as good a place to find me as any. I had jimray.me and it expired because there was something about the .me domain that just feels icky. And so I have jimray.co, but I haven't set it up yet. So, I don't know. When is this going to air? Maybe I'll get it set up between now and then.
I think like a month from now, actually. So you have some time.
Oh, I've got plenty of time. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Excellent.
Whatever. I mean, if you're listening to this show and you can't deal with the 404, just stop listening.
Right.
Yeah, that's it, I guess. I mean, yeah, you can't talk about your company yet. So get out of here, buddy. Thanks all for talking. It's been a lot of fun. I didn't cover half of the web techie stuff that I wanted, but I think we got a better discussion out of it.
We'll have you back.
We had a good discussion, and I would love to come back anytime.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks again, Jim.
Yeah, thank you guys.
I want to once again thank Drobo for supporting the show. Smart storage to protect what matters. They've got the new Gen 3 Drobo, 3 to 5 times faster, USB 3.0, one or two. Protect against one or two hard drive failures, optimized for Time Machine. It is just great. But no matter which Drobo you want, all you have to do is go to www.drobostore.com, use offer code DEBUG50, save $50 off your next Drobo. Thanks, Drobo.